You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. Consequences of every action. That is something that we must always keep in mind. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam in the hadith, he says, تَرْكُ الْخَطِيئَةِ أَيْسَرُ مِنْ طَلَبِ التَّوْبَةِ. He says, to leave and to avoid, to abandon a sin is much easier than seeking repentance, which is very logical, isn't it? For example, instead of me having to go beg someone to forgive me for the fact that I took his ghibah and I was backbiting him and causing myself all this emotional stress and putting myself in this embarrassment situation, in the first place, I shouldn't backbite anyone. And instead of me having to apologize to people for things I've taken from them from the first place, I shouldn't have to. So the Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying simply, it is to avoid something is better than seeking repentance for it. Same thing when it comes to our desires. I mean, you know, why should I find myself on my prayer mat crying and killing myself over a sin that I could have avoided? I could have stopped. You know, to pray to Allah, to cry to Allah out of love is much different than to cry to Him out of repentance. You see the difference? And then the Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, وَكَمْ مِنْ شَهْوَةِ سَاعَةٍ أَوْرَثَتْ حَزْنًا طَوِيلًا. And how many of desires and pleasures that would last, you know, minutes and seconds, but they will give you, they will inherit a long time pain and sadness. Obviously, especially in Day of Judgment, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala orders the sinners to go to hellfire. I mean, why are they going to hellfire? Is it because Allah is cruel to them? Is it because Allah wishes to punish His people? Is it because He gives him honor and pride to burn people? No. It's only because people sent themselves to these places with their own hands because they were slaves to their passions and their desires. So that will definitely inherit plenty of sadness and plenty of pain for a long, long time. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, be careful of what you do. In order for you to control your desires, think of their consequences. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواه از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
With record inflation already established and long-term recession looming, few could deny that Europe's sanctions war on Russia has backfired economically so far. A new poll from a top French TV news channel has found that the French have become extremely pessimistic about the conflict in Ukraine and increasingly fed up with the price they have to pay for a country which is not even a part of the European Union or the Eurozone. The poll found that almost 60% want the sanctions on Russia to stop or be reduced if they have too big an impact on the average French person's purchasing power.
Les sanctions et de façon irresponsable et anti-économique.
These sanctions are totally irresponsible from an economic and social point of view. Russia is the only one benefiting from the sanctions, and they've made incredible profits on the increase in oil prices. This is not a situation which can last, given the poor economic state of France and the Eurozone.
France is split almost 50-50 on the question of, has military and financial aid to Ukraine been effective? Almost 85% of those polled think the war will drag on for years.
Je parle des Américains surtout qui poussent. Les Européens, ils suivent comme...
The situation is that the Americans are pushing, and the Europeans are following. Not one American is dying in this war, and they have all the energy they need, unlike Europe. Europe needs to say, no, war is not a solution. And if they don't say this, soon their economies are going to be smashed, and the average person is going to be quite angry with their leaders.
The poll goes against the stated positions of Brussels, Paris, and France's mainstream media moguls, but the economic difficulty of the French working class is extremely hard to suppress. There were over 100 arrests in Paris last weekend, at a protest of the economic-based Yellow Vest movement. Many wonder if the French will increasingly brave well-known police and judicial repression in order to protest an unequal economy which appears certain to only worsen. After the coronavirus pause, the Yellow Vests have been marching nationwide every Saturday since their season 2 began in October of 2021. However, French mainstream media have essentially had a blackout on the group since June 2019. While Europe is warning that energy shortages are likely to produce a winter of frosty discontent, the new poll shows a majority of France had already grown weary of sanctions on Russia by the twilight of summer. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Members of the British-led Commonwealth could amount a mass exodus of the bloc following the death of British royal Queen Elizabeth II. With republican movements gaining ground from Australia to the Bahamas, the new King Charles III could see his royal domain shrink below the current 14 countries he currently rules over.
Barbados was the last country to leave, becoming a republic just last year. Jamaica has also expressed a strong desire to follow suit with a referendum planned in 2025. On Monday, the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda said that his nation should have a vote on whether they should keep the royal family as head of state within the next few years. Elsewhere, Australia and New Zealand have witnessed renewed calls for a public debate on the matter to decide what they should do going forward.
Founded in 1931, the Commonwealth is a collection of countries which were former dominions of the British Empire. Following the global demand for greater freedom, the Empire was forced to grant more independence to its remaining territories. The Commonwealth Charter claims the bloc works towards shared goals of prosperity, democracy, and peace. So why would so many member states be this seemingly eager to quit? Press TV asked Dr. Salman Butt for his thoughts.
I don't really think there's much commonwealth about it. I mean, it's a bunch of countries, unfortunately, that share one thing in common, which they've been completely destroyed and, you know, and terrorized by the same kind of empire. There is this underlying kind of neo-imperialist agenda and soft power that's being, you know, still being imposed on other countries, especially so-called, you know, third world countries, which, by the way, the reason why they're the third world now is because of, unfortunately, being systematically destroyed, deindustrialized, and kind of pillaged by empire, British Empire.
The new King and Queen are expected to launch a tour in 2023, visiting a number of Commonwealth nations in an attempt to combat the rise in anti-monarchy sentiment. Their performance could decide the fate of their shrinking royal realm. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Amid mutual accusations of obstructing the UN brokered truce, the UN Security Council called on both parties of the war in Yemen to urgently intensify peace talks in order to expand the truce that could translate into a durable ceasefire.
Reopening of the Sana'a airport and the port of Hodeidah fully and paying suspended salaries are basic conditions for reaching an extension of the armistice or a solution to a permanent ceasefire in Yemen. There is no longer a way to waive these conditions, as there are basic rights of the Yemeni people to feel that there is a real change and an improvement in the humanitarian situation.
Observers say the national delegation will likely reject the renewal of the truce since no progress has been made so far to find a solution regarding paying the government employees whose salaries are suspended since 2016 as a result of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The national delegation was refusing to extend the truce for the third time and did not agree until the mediation of Oman. At the time, an agreement was made regarding the unpaid salaries. Unfortunately, nothing has been achieved so far. Therefore, I think that the national delegation will not agree to extend the truce for a fourth time until radical solutions are found regarding the salaries.
The Security Council highlighted the tangible benefits of the UN brokered truce to the Yemeni people, including the flow of fuel through Hodeidah port. However, the Yemeni Petroleum Company says Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on fuel imports.
Yemenis say the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its commitments under the UN agreement over the past months. Therefore, the national delegation says it will continue the talks only to reach a solution that completely ends the war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Life is not yet hectic in central Berlin on an end of summer Monday. As Berliners gradually return to work, for many it is difficult not to turn on to the energy issues afflicting the country. The recent announcement by Russia to halt gas deliveries to Germany via the key pipeline Nord Stream 1 for an indefinite period has sparked fears of power shortages next winter and fueled inflation.
Of course I'm worried. The energy crisis is a pressing issue for all Germans. We're moving back to coal-powered plants, and just some of our nuclear power plants are likely to be kept online. And the soaring price of energy, how could I not be worried?
Germany has been trying to reduce its natural gas usage by 20% to avoid an energy shortage this winter. Some large cities in the countries are limiting heating and turning off gas lights to save on natural gas. Germany has decided to replace all Russian energy imports, most notably natural gas, by as soon as the end of 2024. Moscow accounted for 55% of Berlin's gas imports in 2021, a level that declined to 26% by the end of June. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has so far met this gas challenge through a combination of measures, including diversified sources of LNG imports and subsidies.
Can Germany then completely avoid Russian gas? That's an important question. And that depends on several factors. The major factor is the ability of the states to provide LNG to Germany. And also the ability and the interest of Germany to subscribe contracts that are long-term contracts, 10-year contracts for LNG supply.
Meanwhile, German inflation hit almost 8% in August, and earlier this month, the Olaf Scholz government unveiled a new multi-billion euro relief package to help households cope with skyrocketing energy prices. On Monday, the IFO Institute for Economic Research predicted the German economy will fall into recession next year. IFO also warned that the first quarter of 2023 will be particularly rough for consumers, with inflation soaring to around 11%. Max Civili, Berlin.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will, to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967.
So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise, and on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance, but for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing, with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis. I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly over pay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Saeed Pourreza, London.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Programme. The UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan, limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food.
As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some are selling second-hand items to pay their debt and bills, since they have been unemployed for months. I don't know what I will do in the coming month to make ends meet.
The Taliban Deputy Economy Minister blamed the economic crisis on 2 decades of U.S. occupation and Washington sanctions on the war-ravaged country.
Today's deteriorating economic situation in our country is a legacy of the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. never let Afghan national economic bodies grow or become self-sufficient. All the U.S. did was to keep Afghanistan a consumer country and dependent on U.S. aid. Likewise, after the withdrawal, the U.S. seized Afghanistan's assets and cut international funding. As a result, the U.S. is to blame for Afghanistan's fragile economy.
In the meantime, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has announced that 25 million people in Afghanistan are living in poverty, and 19 million people are facing food insecurity. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres arrived in Pakistan to see climate-induced devastation from months of deadly record floods that have left 500,000 people living in tents under the open sky and have left nearly 1,400 deaths. During his visit, the UN chief and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif discussed the latest situation in the country. The two focused on joint efforts to carry out relief, rescue, and rehabilitation at the international level to mitigate the sufferings of the flood-affected people. Later, the visiting UN chief also met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and assured him of every support possible. The UN Secretary General, who has launched a global appeal to raise $160 million in flood assistance for Pakistan, says Pakistan is one of the countries most affected by climate change in recent months.
Developed countries must step up and provide Pakistan and other countries on the front lines with the financial and technical resources they need to survive extreme weather events like these deadly floods.
Bhutto said that his government is trying its best to help people who had lost everything in floods, but international help would be required to overcome the catastrophe.
I cannot shelter 33 million families. I cannot provide the food and clothing for 35 million families. We don't have the infrastructure in place. And this is just the rescue and relief phase.
The UN chief will travel to areas most impacted by the climate catastrophe. He will interact with the displaced families and oversee the UN's humanitarian response and relief efforts for millions of affected people.
As the floods continue to ravage Pakistan, UN agencies and several countries continue to send aid to flood-affected people in recent weeks. However, Pakistani authorities believe that more assistance is required to help millions of flood victims. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed, because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
By shying away from graphic images of death, news organizations sanitize the violence of Israeli regime aggression against Palestinians. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Elise Swain and Alice Sperry, writers. This article is published under the heading, Americans Rarely See the True Face of Israeli Regime's Bombing of Gaza. Here's the story. When a ceasefire ended a three-day Israeli regime offensive in the Gaza Strip, over 350 Palestinians were wounded and 46 were dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials. Media coverage in the U.S. was mainly led by photographs of smoke-filled skies or Gazans walking amid piles of rubble. While the photos were accurate and recent, the safety of selecting these images rather than graphic ones effectively portrayed a reality for American audiences far removed from what had truly unfolded on the ground. To look at the totality of images that are made during a news event is an experience most Americans, with the exception of photo editors in newsrooms, rarely experience. As the Palestinian death toll climbed over the weekend, images from photojournalists based in Gaza poured into massive databases like Getty Images and AP Images. A quick search for Gaza on Getty Images, for example, retains hundreds of recent photographs, a near-endless grid of brutality from the last week. In many images, children killed by Israeli regime bombs are displayed prominently. These images show funerals, the faces of the deceased uncovered, their bodies held aloft and marched through the streets. In some photographs, mourners are seen taking their own images of the bodies on their cell phones, proof of what horrors have occurred. These graphic images are arrayed on photo databases next to the non-graphic images that are almost always selected for publication by U.S. news organizations. Rockets flying through the sky at night, quiet moments of children surveying the damage done to their homes, and black smoke rising over the horizon. In Gaza, photojournalists routinely photograph within hospitals and morgues. This access to urgent care facilities, rare in the United States, provides an opportunity for journalists to directly document the wounded and dead. On Getty Images, images of children's bodies wrapped in white fabric piling up at the morgue are abundant and uncensored. While shocking and deeply upsetting, they do show very clearly what bombing dense residential areas produces. I can still see the grieving people weeping after their homes were destroyed, Palestinian photojournalist Hossam Salem told The Intercept, adding, I can't handle it anymore. Even after these 3 days of Israeli regime attacks are over, I have become more drained than before. In Gaza, there are no stories that can give us life. All we can say is how death has taken our lives and the lives of those around us. In general, the majority of coverage by international and American media is weak and often does not show scenes where innocent women and children were killed. Soleiman Haji, a Palestinian visual journalist working in Gaza, told The Intercept. In the case of one of the 16 children killed, 5-year-old Alaa Qadoom, one report in the New York Times included a photograph made after her death. This was the exception, though the photo was not featured prominently. It was placed near the end of the article. Other outlets from the Washington Post to NBC News did not publish the image, even as they mentioned the girl's killing. What we are left with is, in essence, a sanitized and avoidant understanding of world events as newsrooms uniformly opt for images that do not include any graphic content. Social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have enforced this shift away from publishing depictions of violence by implementing sensitive media policies that discourage newsrooms from prominently displaying images of atrocities lest they lose page views. There is no consensus on how to deal with images of intense violence. Individual newsrooms make decisions on a case-by-case basis, often after sorting through troves of images filed to major distribution platforms where none of the images are blurred or censored. On getting images only within the caption information is there sometimes an editor's notes warning the viewer about what they're already looking at. Image depicts death. Most media outlets, including this one, issue an editor's note or content warning before surprising viewers with depictions of graphic violence. It is not just Palestinian bodies that are erased from mass media accounts of massacres. School shootings in America and the scenes that have become visually defined by makeshift memorials and candlelit visuals rather than graphic images. And the same is true for the bloodshed that occurs overseas, but there are exceptions. The problem with the representation of Palestinian life and death goes well beyond the images selected to tell the story. Palestinians and many foreign observers have long condemned the international media for sanitizing the Zionist regime's crimes and deferring to the Israeli regime's narrative. In a letter signed by more than 500 journalists following yet another Israeli regime bombing campaign on Gaza last year, the authors, including several Intercept reporters, argued that coverage of the Israeli regime and Palestine regularly amounts to journalistic malpractice. The asymmetry in context does not just extend to the language we use. Stories tend to disproportionately amplify Israeli regime narratives while suppressing Palestinian ones, the group wrote. Obfuscating Israeli regime's oppression of Palestinians fails this industry's own objectivity standards. Ahmad Abu Artma, a Palestinian writer and human rights activist who in 2018 was one of the organizers of the Great March of Return, a peaceful protest movement by the fence separating the Zionist regime from Gaza, told Intercept that the Israeli regime operated on the assumption that they would have an ally in most of the international media. He said, "This is complicity. We don't want anything more than for people to know the facts. We don't have a complicated narrative. Our demand is only that people watch the facts, watch the reality, see the footage of what's happening." Across newsrooms, the safe choices of showing an abstracted violence, including calm moments of smoke and rubble, over overt violence, including death injury or mourning fall in line with the framework of the coverage itself, which in Gaza's case regularly downplays the impact of civilians in favor of a narrative about Palestinian militancy, even as the same kind of militancy is depicted as resistance in Ukraine. Mohammad Mohawesh, an independent Palestinian journalist and researcher based in Gaza, argued in an interview with The Intercept that coverage of the latest Gaza assault, which Israeli regime officials admitted was preemptive, focused almost exclusively on the Zionist regime's ostensible justification for attack rather than its impact. And even though the majority of victims were not engaged in acts of resistance, the portrayal of Palestinian resistance, he added, stands in a stark contrast with that of the Ukrainian people. For the past month, newspapers and websites and social media have been filled with the stories of Ukrainian resistance and heroism, stories about soldiers blowing up bridges to delay the approach of Russian tanks and sacrificing themselves in the process. We have seen civilians attacking armed vehicles with whatever they have and common people receiving weapons training and digging trenches, Mohawesh said, adding, and yet, if any of these stories took place in Palestine rather than Ukraine, they would of course not be perceived as acts of heroism and resistance. They would only be classified and condemned as terror. Mohawesh stressed the comparison was not intended to diminish the resistance of the Ukrainian people, but to uphold the right to resist the occupation, military intervention of any land by any nation.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, and ulama all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Sheikh Mahtavi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom and Dr. Fakhwani from the University of Qom. Dr. Fakhwani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Very welcome to the program, the teacher, and Sheikh Mahtavi. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one such outstanding figures among the Shiite scholars and authors, Sheikh Asadullah Haidar, mainly known as Asad Haidar, one of the outstanding researchers of Shiite world and the Shiite, we can say, studies, who was born in Najaf in the country Iraq. He's an Iraqi scholar. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about his life and his magnum opus, Ma'al Hussein fi Nahzatihi. Dr. Fakhwani, give us some details about the biography of Asad Haidar.
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, Asad Haidar was born in the year 1327, according to Hijra calendar, in Najaf, and his father, Muhammad ibn Isa bin Muhammad Ali Haidar, was one of the students of a famous Najaf-based mujtahid, Sheikh Muhammad Taha Najaf.
Yes.
Later on, because of the oppressions of the ex-Ba'athist party in Najaf that exerted too much pressure on Shias, Asad Haidar was forced to leave Najaf, and from Najaf he went to Kuwait because, yes. I mean, for various purposes, because of the, I mean, the Shi community in Kuwait are really very powerful in terms of financial capacities, and culturally speaking, the Shi'is of Kuwait are very much close to the Shi'i communities of southern Iraq. Because of this, we find that many Iraqis prefer, I mean, at that time, in the time of Saddam, preferred to go to Kuwait and from there to other places.
That's right.
The late Asad Haider passed away in the year 1405, according to Hijra calendar, in Kuwait, and his body was taken to Najaf for burial purposes.
That's right.
Regarding the studies of the schooling of Asad Haider, it must be indicated that since he was born in Najaf, he had access to various madrasas, ulamas, and, I mean, teaching curriculums over there. He received the initial lessons, and for his advanced studies, he enjoyed the lessons and lectures of the great or grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen al-Hakim and Sayyid Abul Ghassim al-Musawi al-Khu'i in Najaf. However, at that time, he had frequent encounters with the late Allama Amini, who encouraged him not to do superficial jobs, but rather to embark on very serious academic activities. One of the reasons that Asad Haider developed his book, Al-Imam Sadiq wal-Madhahib al-Arba'i, was because initially he wanted to write just a column, or for example, two columns for an Arabic newspaper or daily in Baghdad. However, the late Allama Amini suggested him not to spoil the name of Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam in a local newspaper or daily paper published in Baghdad, rather to develop something quite worthwhile on Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. And the result was that this book, the text that was supposed to be published in like a short article turned into a 6-volume book.
Al-Imam As-Sadiq wal-Mazahib al-Arba. This is his most outstanding work, isn't it?
Yes.
A really comprehensive book about Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Also answering some of the doubts of Ibn Khaldun is another outstanding.
Yes, since at that time, I'm sure that at that time, Najaf was in its golden age. The Najaf Seminary was in its golden age. This was because, not only from Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India, but also from many other places, especially from the Arab lands, for example, from the Shi-populated areas in Syria, as well as from Lebanon, there were many students and teachers available in Najaf. Because of the presence over there and because of the international activities of Beirut-based Arab publishers, those scholars who were in Najaf had direct and easy access to books published elsewhere in the greater Muslim communities. Because of this, he found it very interesting to answer some of the doubts created by Ibn Khaldun. Because as you know, Ibn Khaldun in the world is regarded as one of the founders of sociology in the Muslim world. However, he wanted to answer some of the doubts that he created or fabricated in his Muqaddama, introduction to his great, historical compendium.
That's all right. Yes. Okay.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
But Sheikh Mahtavi, he is also known by his another book about Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ma al-Husayn fi Nahzatihi. What is this book?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think as a good introduction to talk about this book, we have to also add top of the information that our dear doctor just mentioned, that Asad Haider also is regarded as one of the very powerful, influential orator and speaker at the same time poets of his time.
Okay.
That's why he was forced by the Ba'athi regime of Iraq at that time to leave the Iraq to Kuwait, and you see that he passed away over there because of his passionate, influential speech that they would believe that it's going to encourage and motivate people to go against the government. That's why they deported him from his homeland to Kuwait. So this is a good introduction to know that when it comes to Imam Hussein to offer a book regarding Imam Hussein, definitely from such a very powerful spirit, we are going to have a very influential book and a great book regarding the personality of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, since he had benefited from the great ulama. As a doctor just mentioned, namely Sayyid Abul Qasim Khoui, namely Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Qasim Khoui, and the rest of the great ulama of that golden age of the Najaf. So it was expected from his personality to dedicate his life more into generating and producing books regarding fiqh and usul and other scholarly topics of Hausa. But we see how one meeting with Allama Amini has affected him to dedicate his life to talk about Ahlul Bayt, mainly Imam Hussein alayhi salam in this book. And you say, Ma'al Hussein fi nahdhati, to be with Hussein or accompanying Hussein in his uprising. So when we start talking about the content of the book, we see how he has categorized all topics of the book into 11 chapters, starting from the biography of Imam Hussein, then some introductory information and the time of vicegerency of Yazid La'natullah alayh, and starting the uprising, sending Muslim ibn Aqil as Imam Hussein delegate to Kufa in response to the letters that Imam Hussein had received from the great or big heads of Kufa. And then in the sixth chapter, we see he is talking about the starting the journey of Imam Hussein from Mecca to Kufa. And in seventh chapter, he talks about the siege against the Imam Hussein out of the Kufa, and the rest of the topics coming one after another in 8, 9, and the rest of the
11, actually, in whole 11 sessions. Also about Zainab al-Kubra, we can say Talibiyun, you know, the events that took place after the Shahada of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This book has been also translated to Farsi as Hamgam ba Nahdhat Husseini. That's all right, Ma'al Hussein fi Nahdhatihi. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, how did you find this book, brother? I mean, the scholarly speaking, are these sources authentic or not?
Yes. First of all, it goes back to, I mean, this should be analyzed based on two parameters. One, the sources Asad Haider used, and another one, his approach to the movement of Imam al-Husseinism. Concerning the sources that he used, all of them are authentic. I mean, at that time in Najaf, it wasn't customary for people to write about any of the infallible imams, and particularly about Imam al-Hussein al-Islam, using unreliable sources. Okay. However, regarding his approach, it must be indicated that, like some of his successors, I mean, academically speaking, or I mean, psychologically speaking, like, for example, the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, Asad Haider seems to have a political orientation toward the movement of Imam al-Hussein al-Islam. However, since he was educated in a, since Asad Haider himself educated in a school, in a school of thought, heavily influenced by moral or ethical attitudes, from time to time he comes to focus on the moral values highlighted by Imam al-Hussein al-Salam in his movement. We know that the movement of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam, as Imam al-Hussein al-Salam, emphasized, it wasn't a movement to be expected to result in very shining political upheavals or political gains, rather. The end point was nothing but martyrdom. From this perspective, we find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam's victory wasn't a military victory, it was a moral victory. It was, I should like to say that it was a software victory, not hardware victory.
That's all right.
Because of this, we find that Asad Haider was successful in portraying, giving another portrayal of the universally eternal movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Still, many other scholars, when they come to pay attention to the movement of Imam al-Hussein, they find ample space to talk and to analyze.
That's all right. Yes. Thank you much, Dr. Fakhwani and Sheikh Mahtabi, for a presence in the program. The teacher talking about Sheikh Asadullah Haider, can say the author of Al-Imam al-Sadiq wal-Mazahib al-Arba'a and the book Ma'al Hussein fi Nahsatihi, which is about Imam al-Hussein's movement. This outstanding man passed away in the year 1405, according to the Hijra calendar in Kuwait, and his body was taken in the holy city of Najaf, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless his soul. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.